You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll hear about who's taking the most risks on the road, and it may not be who you think.
First, last week, Wisconsin Department of Corrections Secretary John Litcher told a legislative committee that troubled youth prison Lincoln Hills is trying to minimize the use of solitary confinement, but he said the practice is needed in some cases to bolster safety and security.
He joins us now to talk about solitary confinement in youth prisons and more. John Litcher is the Wisconsin Department of Corrections Secretary. He oversees the state's juvenile corrections facilities, Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, which are currently undergoing an FBI investigation after allegations of abuse. Secretary Litcher, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, last week you defended the use of solitary confinement at Lincoln Hills Youth Prison. Why do you think that practice is, in your eyes, justified?
Well, I don't think in any type of institutional setting would you want to take away one of the tools that we may need or use. I emphasize to the committee and I emphasize to your listeners that it is always our goal, it continues to be our goal, and there is a number of ways we will reach that goal to minimize the use of what we identify as restrictive housing, and we will continue to do that, and that minimization is crucial in the well-being of the institution. But to eliminate it completely, it is not as feasible, in our opinion, as to just completely say we will eliminate it.
And you told the State Assembly's Corrections Committee during a hearing that an average of 17% of the prison's population is in solitary at once, and that's closing in on 20% in solitary confinement at one time. Are you comfortable with that number?
Well, yes, it is, because even though that's an accurate statement, we have a step-down process where the young man or the young lady, basically young men, because the young lady is, the young ladies number-wise, even though that's at approximately 15%, the numbers are approximately 3 youth on average at any given day in restrictive housing on the Copper Lake side. But on the Lincoln Hill side, it's basically a step-down program where they may not be in intensified restrictive housing from a person's perspective for just a very short period of time, some possibly hours, some possibly 1 or 2 days. But even in that type of a setting, they are out of their housing unit room, which is what those are. It's not the typical restrictive housing as you would see in a male institution, but it's one of the cottages that we use for restrictive housing, out of their restrictive housing room for approximately 2 to 4 hours a day for programming, for education, for meals, for showers, for a number of activities. So when we use the term restrictive housing on the juvenile side, it is different than the concept or use of restrictive housing at times on the adult side.
So you're saying restrictive housing at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake is different than a solitary confinement in an adult prison? Are they
oh,
not?
Absolutely.
Why aren't they the same thing?
Well, simply because of the type of programming that you do. We attempt to get the youth out much more, not only on a daily basis, but also on a step-down basis, basically starting after immediate evaluation of the incident that might have got the youth into a concept of restrictive housing. The units themselves are different. It's different than on the adult side. I mean, some of the reasons are the same, either because of behaviors, assaults, or other types of actions that might warrant some time of, I'm going to use this terminology, some may not agree with it, but a timeout from their general population responsibilities of education, programming, and meeting groups. But that because they have that in restrictive housing, it is in the out time of a housing unit room is much more than on the adult side. Even though on the adult side we're trying to get to the 10-10 concept, on the juvenile side we get to that concept much, much quicker because it's an immediate evaluation of that youth's needs on an individual basis, and our step down process is probably quicker after evaluation of that youth.
How long might a young person be put in solitary confinement, or as you say, restrictive housing?
Well, Yeah, everybody has, it's different for each individual, but as Deputy Administrator McCulley said that day, it can be hours, or in some respects, it could be days. Each one is different. So the fact of the matter is that you try to evaluate the incident, you evaluate the youth, you evaluate his programming, and I'm speaking now gender-specific, but the same would go for girls, and you evaluate also the aspect of the youth's interaction in that housing unit or restrictive housing unit, such that you may make their step-down process almost immediate. Some may take 2 to 3 to 4, maybe longer days. So I can't tell you specifically because each incident may be different. But the issue that I'm trying to emphasize to you and your listeners is that evaluation is immediate. The step-down process is relatively soon thereafter. And for some, it's truly like a timeout until they're able to, I think, resurrect their own self-discipline to be able to go back into their general housing activities.
Now, many advocates for corrections reform make the case that even for adults, and here in this case we're talking about juveniles, about young people, teenagers, et cetera, that solitary confinement is cruel and that it can be extremely damaging psychologically, especially for young minds, maybe like the teenagers at Lincoln Hills. What do you say to that?
Well, we work closely with professional groups, the Council of Juvenile Correction Administrators. We work closely with all professional groups that deal with what I would state is the overall well-being of youth that are in some kind of a confinement area, and even in general population at Lincoln Hills, that's a confinement of youth. I would argue that you have to define confinement very, very specifically. But if you look at restrictive housing, let's use that terminology, 73% of the state still, based upon our research and our checking as we went in front of the committee, use some form of prohibitive or punitive restrictive housing. 14 states do not. But even those states, the other states that have, they talk about things as administrative confinement for treatment. Those are all euphemisms for some type of specialized confinement within an institution. So I'm saying that I dramatically, and I think our staffs want to dramatically reduce the use of or minimize the time in restrictive housing, but we know it's a tool that inside the institution setting cannot be, from our perspective, eliminated totally, because you still will have, for safety and security reasons of the young adults themselves, a need for some type of separation at times.
We're speaking with John Litcher right now, Wisconsin's new secretary for the Department of Corrections. He oversees the state's juvenile corrections facilities that we're talking about right now, Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, which are undergoing an FBI investigation currently after allegations of abuse. And I want to ask you some bigger picture questions now, Secretary Litcher. Some people in Milwaukee in particular are hoping for a change that would move the facility closer to the city. Right now it's located in the woods of northern Wisconsin. Is moving the facility or opening a new one closer perhaps to urban center something that's maybe on the table?
Well, I think there has been discussions with Milwaukee County officials, and I think those discussions do not end. But the reality is Milwaukee has to also make some decisions. On the proposal that was put forth some time ago, they wanted to just be responsible for smaller elements of confinement of these type of youth. When I say small elements, the smaller elements, I mean, in time-wise, it is important as far as the programming and various treatment groups, but they did not want to be responsible for security. They did not want to be responsible for psychological helping of these youth. They did not want to be responsible for the medical activities of these youth. So that kind of a bifurcated supervision system, we think, has problems connected with it. In respect to where our institution of a Type 1 institution is, it is at Lincoln Hills, Copper Lakes, and just outside of Merrill, Wisconsin. And I don't argue that transportation isn't an issue. I think that, I mean, the distance is there. But that is our Type 1 institution. Now, we have Type 2 institutions once they're released from Lincoln Hills and Copper Lakes that are much closer to those type of populations. But with the giving transportation to parents in the Milwaukee area, in the Green Bay area, in the Dane County area, we try to accommodate as much as possible those type of transportation and visitation issues and connectivity. But as I say, all the metropolitan units, they have made a decision for some reason that they are going to send their young men and or women to Lincoln Hills for a shorter period of time. And as I stated, I believe the average stay on the juvenile side is approximately 10 to 11 months, and on the serious juvenile offense, it's from like 11 to 13 months. So the time at Lincoln Hills Copper Lakes is a much shorter perspective than when you think of an incarcerated time for an adult.
Now, as we wrap up, you took over as Corrections Secretary after Edwall left amid allegations of abuse, as we said, at Lincoln Hills that resulted in that ongoing FBI investigation. And you've said you want to restore trust in the agency. What challenges and opportunities do you see to do that in your new role?
Well, one of them is having the pleasure of talking with you and your listeners. I mean, I think when we continue to tell our story of what we're doing in respect to the changes we're making in both in the of our pre-service academy training for our youth counselors, where we deal dramatically in verbal de-escalation, dealing with mental health training for our youth counselors, adolescent brain debarment, trauma-informed care, all the different types of enhancements we've done on training, the expansion we're using with our psychological services, both inside Lincoln Hills Copper Lakes specifically and outside as far as coordinated activities, those type of situations, plus the fact that we're getting a better handle on our recruiting and filling our positions at Lincoln Hills through local recruitment and local training. I think when I speak of retraining, of reengaging trust in the situation, it's what type of program, treatment, and educational setting we're delivering. And I think they are of extremely high quality now, and I think it reinforces my belief that that helps reestablish trust. Now, trust is a word that everybody has to internalize themselves, but the processes, the changes we've made, the dealing with youth complaints in a better process, the evaluation of use of force not only on an immediate basis but also on a weekly basis at here in central office by our administrators and dealing with those immediately such that we're observing and eliminating any type of allegations in respect to abuse of that nature. I think all those changes help reestablish trust, but it's a long process. This didn't happen overnight, and I understand that it's going to take long stability and evaluation of our programs and continued evaluation of our programs to meet that goal that I stated on my confirmation hearing statements.
Secretary Litcher, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That was John Litcher, Wisconsin Department of Corrections Secretary. He oversees the state's juvenile corrections facilities, Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, which are currently undergoing an FBI investigation after allegations of abuse. He joined us to talk about why he defends the use of solitary confinement in youth prisons and more. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump announced that he wants to increase military spending by about $54 billion. We'll look at what that can mean and ask for your thoughts.
First, when it comes to determining the riskiest drivers on the road, many of us are eager to point the finger at inexperienced teenage drivers. But according to a new report from the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety, there's a different group we should be keeping an eye on.
Younger millennials, more specifically drivers between the ages of 19 and 24, appear to be the worst behaved drivers on American roads. The report finds that 88% of young millennials have admitted to engaging in at least one risky behavior behind the wheel in the past 30 days, such as texting and driving or running a red light.
Nick Jarmus joins us now to talk more about this study and its results. He's Director of Public Affairs for AAA Wisconsin. Nick, welcome back to the show.
My pleasure to be here.
So I'm sure millennials are tired of the negative headlines coming out about them, but are members of this generation really the most poorly behaved drivers on the road?
Well, right now they are, and it's important for us to, as we move forward, try and figure out what aspects of this are a generational issue. What's tied to just this age group or this period of a person's development versus characteristics of this cohort as they grow and move up through the age ranks in the future. But right now, they are the age group that is most likely to engage in dangerous behavior like texting, using drugs or alcohol before getting behind the wheel, speeding, running red lights, a variety of other things that we ask about in our survey.
So to go back to your earlier point, are you saying it's possible that this cohort of young people could simply grow out of these behaviors and then it's something that the next generation does?
It's possible. I mean, one thing that we do know about this current generation that's in this age group, so these younger millennials, many of them opted out of driver's ed as teens. So as graduated driver's license programs were implemented, the cost of driver's ed in many school districts began to rise. Or for other social reasons, they simply either couldn't afford to take driver's ed or didn't see the need to get their driver's license during their teen years. So they simply waited, and once they turned 18, they were able to go to the DMV and just get their license without taking a formal driver's training class or without going through the graduated driver's license system where they gain experience under supervised conditions. And I think we're seeing some of the effects of that on the roadways now. This age group is also the most likely to be involved in crashes, most likely to be injured, and unfortunately most likely to be killed on the roads here in Wisconsin, according to our crash data.
But don't they still have to pass some kind of driver's test, with someone who's evaluating them?
They do, but I think the distinction is that even though they may know what the right thing to do is, or they may know what the rules are, it's very important for drivers of any age to understand why the rules are what they are. So not just that it's against the law to text message while you're driving, but that, texting while you're driving divides your attention, basically creates what we call inattention blindness, where you're not actually in control of the vehicle anymore, and that it can lead to very dangerous situations on the road. And that creates a sort of a self-policing mechanism in them, where it's not that they're not texting just because they're afraid of getting a ticket for it, but they're not doing it because they understand how dangerous it can be.
How do other age groups compare to millennials when it comes to these behaviors? Are millennials way out there, or is it kind of close?
They are kind of in a category on their own. If you kind of lump all of the behaviors in together into just a general pool of risky behaviors, millennials age 19 to 24 currently, about 88% say that they've engaged in at least one of these behaviors in the last month. The next group down is the group slightly ahead of them in age 25 to 39. They're almost 10 points behind them, so about 79%. Say that they engage in those behaviors, and then jumps down to 75% when you talk about 40 to 59-year-olds. And then teens are actually now in fourth place, in sort of unfortunate competition, so to speak, where they're at 69% say that they engage in these behaviors at least once in the past month.
Is it possible that millennials are just more honest than other people, and maybe these other generations are just not copping to doing these same behaviors?
It could be, but we do know that one of the big behaviors that's out there is the distracted driving issue. And with the popularity of smartphones, this millennial generation really, they were the first adapters with these devices, and they've really incorporated it into their culture and into their social networks to where it's hard for them to separate. And it's also important that they came of age and, got their license as teens when we were still figuring out what the implications of the combination of phones and cars were. So whereas today's teenagers are constantly hearing, from the very beginning, before they even start driver's ed, about how dangerous it is to use their phones behind the wheel, similar to how they hear how dangerous it is to drink and drive behind the wheel. Millennials, you know, some of them may not have gotten those messages until they had already started driving, already gotten into the habit of doing that. And once you get into the habit of that, it's very hard to break out of it.
I read a newspaper piece or two where actual millennials were interviewed about this finding, and they said, no, that can't really be true. We're native users, like you were saying, and therefore we're good at multitasking. We can drive and we can use our phones. We're probably much better than these other drivers on the road who are trying to do that. Is there something to that, that this generation could be better at using technology and also driving?
In some cases, yes. I mean, but it's important to remember that there's a difference between multitasking and what the technical term would be toggle tasking. And so if you're talking about two different activities that are using two different parts of your brain at the same time, you can do that. That's why you can walk and chew gum at the same time. It's not taking the same parts of your brain to process those activities. But when you're talking about manipulating a smartphone and driving a vehicle, that actually does take the same parts of your brain. And there have been studies that AAA has also sponsored in the past that have done in-depth brainwave studies to show that it's the same centers in your brain that are activated by both activities. So you're actually just, you're physically not able to do both of those activities at the same time. So if you're behind the wheel and you're engaged with your phone, you're really not driving in any meaningful sense. You're behind the wheel, but you're not in control of the vehicle mentally anymore. And so they're switching back and forth between those things, which is very different than multitasking and doing them both at the same time.
Nick, we leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Nick Jarmus, Director of Public Affairs for AAA Wisconsin. He joined us to talk about a recent AAA report that looked at the riskiest drivers on the road, millennials, and what we can do about it.
Coming up, we'll get a reaction to the news that President Trump wants to increase military spending by over $50 billion. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Latino USA. On tonight's episode, what you don't expect when you're expecting. Latino USA shares some of the unexpected twists and turns that can go along with pregnancy. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Now, President Trump announced yesterday that he plans to cut spending on many federal government programs and shift billions more in funding to the armed forces.
The president proposed an increase of military spending by $54 billion. The White House says this would increase the defense budget by 10%. This is the first indication of spending priorities for the new administration. President Trump will give a speech tonight to a joint session of Congress, and he'll submit his budget to Congress next month.
Kevin Barron has been following this issue. He joins us now to talk about the proposal to increase military spending. He's executive director for Defense One. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. Well, you know, you hear a number, an increase in the budget, but federal budgets work kind of weird. President Obama had been expected to increase the defense budget, as I understand it, just by not this much. Can you put this $54 billion number into context for us?
Well, the context is there is no context. This is a number ahead of a plan, ahead of a policy. It does have some history. It comes from, you know, some budgeteering by a conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation. At the same time, some reporters have already dug up that Obama, back in 2012, in a five-year plan, had proposed a number almost exactly the same for this year. So there's a little bit of history to it, but mostly it's from Donald Trump on the campaign trail saying he's going to increase the defense budget. He's going to buy a lot more ships and planes and tanks, expand the size of the force, and they need money to do that. So this is their first offering. It's money, they said, directly they're going to take from non-defense programs and send it to the Pentagon. But it comes ahead of the Pentagon's own internal review. General Mattis, Secretary Mattis now, is supposed to have a chance to shape a new national security strategy. And from that, the service chiefs of the Army, Air Force, Navy, Marines are supposed to then give their requests for how much they want, how many troops. Instead, they just got a whole lot of cash. if this goes through Congress.
The premise that kind of set this up was the idea that the military has been gutted over the last 8 years. That was something that Donald Trump had been saying for quite a while now. Can you talk about the current state of the military budget and where the military is?
So, yeah, the budget's about $560 billion or $580 billion if you add the war money to it. You know, the characterization of the military as gutted or decimated, it really depends on who you ask and what your perspective is. So on the one hand, you have the Secretary of Defense all year long last year on every single campaign or every single speech saying, this is the greatest fighting force the world has ever known. We reporters heard him say that ad nauseum. Well, you can't have the world's greatest fighting force and also be decimated and unable to fight and have three-quarters of your fighter aircraft grounded for maintenance and only two brigades available for immediate deployment, which are the statistics we started to hear from the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So what we had a campaign where Donald Trump consistently said that the military was gutted, which is frankly not what you hear from inside the military. But then we got to when he becomes elected, and he gets into office, and we have this window where all of the Joint Chiefs are now putting forth statements and speeches and op-eds, including at Defense One, laying out exactly what they want. All of them saying, we need more troops, we need more airmen, we need more sailors, we need more ships, we need more of everything, because the strategy that has been laid upon us by the previous administration and from what Donald Trump is saying he wants to do is just so much more than we are able to do right now. So you have the U.S. military is, you know, by far the biggest and strongest and most powerful. They have the most amazing equipment known to the history of the world. They've got the best fighters in the history of the world. But they're being asked to do so much and with a lot of equipment that, frankly, is a bit outdated.
Let's give a listen to President Trump at a White House meeting yesterday with the nation's governors.
We must ensure that our courageous service men and women have the tools they need to deter war, and when called upon to fight in our name, only do one thing, win. We have to win. We have to start winning wars again. I have to say, when I was young in high school and college, everybody used to say, we never lost a war. We never lost a war. You remember. Some of you are right there with me, and you remember, we never lost a war. America never lost. And now, we never win a war. We never win. And we don't fight to win. We don't fight to win. So we either got to win or don't fight it at all.
So apart from wanting to win wars in the future, what do we know about President Trump's military priorities, as you're saying, what he hopes to accomplish with the U.S. military in the future?
Well, let's stick with what he just said right there, this idea of winning. I mean, this is fascinating to me. I've covered the Pentagon for a decade, and the last time generals talked about winning is about a decade old. It's just not the context by which the military or any serious national security professional approaches terrorism and the global problem of terrorism and the terrorist groups that are being fought. The military top leaders in the last month have come out publicly here in Washington at their bases in writings saying that they want a plan that is more than just the military, that's really whole of government, and that's not new. That's how we've been talking about, you know, these wars all the way up to the beginning of the Iraq War and the insurgency 10 years ago, 15 years ago. So they want much more than just a more robust military fighting ISIS harder to take them out. At the same time, the ISIS war alone has completely changed in the last 6 to 9 months. You know, Iraq is almost completely retaken. Mosul is almost about to fall. Syria has a way to go still. But it's a different kind of war month to month to month. So the idea right now, you've got Trump, who just went down to Tampa to talk to the generals at Central Command and Special Operations Command. He asked them, what does winning look like? He's interested in winning. And they gave him that answer that, well, it's, you know, there's a long project and we want governance on the backside of fighting, or else what are we fighting for? Because we don't want to hold any territory. That's not what the military is for. But he asked about winning, and he was told that. Then he was, you know, last week, General Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, was in D.C. at the Brookings Institute and said that this new counter-ISIS plan they're about to present, it's way more than just the military. It's a whole-of-government approach. And yet, yesterday, Trump came out with a budget that shifts money out of the State Department, out of development and diplomacy, puts more money on the military. So he's clearly focused on this campaign idea of, we're going to build up the military, and I want a military win, and I want it fast. But that's not what I'm hearing from the generals.
Yeah, you mentioned cuts, along with this increase in defense spending, cuts to State Department budgets, cuts to foreign aid. What have we been hearing from past generals and current leaders, for that matter, about the impact of those kind of cuts?
Well, everyone's against it, mostly, and that's not new. That's decades old. I mean, I've been in Washington since 1998, and since the day I stepped foot here, I've heard national security leaders in uniform talk about how they want a bigger State Department and a bigger development, bigger diplomacy and development. A big moment for this several years ago was when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. Robert Gates was the Secretary of Defense. Obama was in the White House, and the Democrats controlled Congress. And at the time, you had Gates and Clinton, who became fast friends in the war against terrorism in Afghanistan and Iraq. And Gates was begging Washington for more money for the State Department. He had offered to mobilize the National Guard in civilian uniforms to take over jobs like building, you know, schools and wells and agricultural work. It wasn't feasible, but it was that urgent for them. And even with a Democratic White House and a Democratic Congress and all those other supporters, it went nowhere. And there was no giant increase of State Department. There was no robust flooding of the world with American diplomats and ideas like there was back in the Cold War. So the idea that anything like that's going to happen now with Trump and with Republicans in charge is fallacy. Instead, it is still just focused on the military. The difference is that plenty of Republicans in Congress who've been leaders in national security, they understand counterterrorism and counterinsurgency, and they also view this as a long war, a long battle that the United States is in, and they understand the military needs help outside of the military. The question is, does Trump? And will Trump and his inner sanctum of civilian policy advisors that he brought in, guys like Steve Bannon and Kushner and the rest, are they going to listen? Who's he going to listen to? Is he going to listen to them and himself, or is he going to listen to General Votel, General Tony Thomas from Special Ops Command, General Dunford, General Mattis, all of these people who are going to be pushing for really a lot more of the same, not a whole lot of things different?
One Republican senator who's pushed back against a lot of what Donald Trump has done is Senator John McCain. Now, he's critical of this increase for not being big enough. He says, hey, it's a dangerous world. We have a lot we need to do with the military. We need even more money. Do you think that's going to be a common sentiment, or is that something unique to Senator McCain?
Oh, I think it's a very common sentiment that far more than this is needed if the United States is going to do what it says it wants to do. Again, start with the strategy for the world. It's supposed to come from the White House first, a national security strategy. Then the Pentagon gets the chance to come up with the defense side of it. Then, again, the Joint Chiefs say, okay, here's what we need in each of our services. Then you can have a military that is built and equipped and staffed to do what is asked of it. That changes year to year to year, and the generals are the first to say that we're 100% wrong at planning the future all the time. So in the last couple of years, what have been the big changes, for example? Well, Putin moving into Crimea, the need to move troops and tanks back in force to Eastern Europe, keeping track of the Chinese and these islands in the South China Sea. These are all demands the military did not have 2 years ago. That can't be brought out of thin air. They take a lot of time to build up. The Marines is a good example. The Marines have wanted to add 20 or 40,000 more Marines to their ranks, and they're probably going to get that money and that authorization this year, but it's going to take several years to build up to that level. And then you're starting at the bottom at privates, so at entry level forces, not recruit sergeants, as they say. So there's a long way to go, and it all has to come from the civilian White House and their vision of the world and how much the United States is going to be a leader abroad in national security and global security, how much the United States military is going to be used to carry that out, to fight terrorism across the Middle East and Africa, to check down Russia, to have submarines and space and cyber, every domain. And that's where it gets very confusing. And frankly, nobody knows yet, because Trump has been all over the map with his rhetoric. Now it's time to, put your money where your mouth is, and the next 3 to 6 months, I think, are going to be very telling of what this White House's priorities are as a governing White House and as a president in office, not a campaigner on the trail.
We're talking to Kevin Barron from Defense One, looking at President Trump's proposal to increase military spending by $54 billion in his federal budget proposal.
And we're taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. What do you think about President Trump's proposal to increase defense spending? What about the cuts to other federal agencies and programs? How would you like to see military policy change in the United States? And what would you like to see the increase in funding go towards in the military? Call now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our discussion now about President Trump's proposal to increase military spending by $54 billion in his federal budget.
We're talking to Kevin Barron, Executive Director for Defense One, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Should we be making substantial increases in military spending in the federal budget? What do you think of the role of the U.S. military in the world? What do you think about cutting things like State Department budgets, foreign aid budgets, to help pay for these increases in military spending? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Kevin, let's talk about the politics of this a little bit. Sure. Someone in Congress who's maybe on the fence on this might say, some of this is going toward a base in my district or a military contractor in my district. It looks a little more attractive then.
Yeah, it does. I think the base argument has a little bit more weight than contracting unless you have a major plant. A lot of folks will mention, for example, when, you know, the F-35, I think, has a part made in every state in the union practically, and that's on purpose, and, you know, every member, it's designed that way, so it's very hard to kill the program if, you know, you're in Congress. I think a little bit of that is old school thinking. More important is this idea of closing bases that saves money. It's something the Pentagon has proposed almost every year for the past about 6 years, I think. And it goes nowhere in Congress. The argument from some is that it actually costs more money in the short term to close bases before you actually see any of the benefits. And frankly, the members who were in had clout on the right committees just weren't going to go for it. So I think I don't know that how much the monetary benefit to individual districts is a real motivator for members to approve or not this budget. I think the bigger concern is you got to go very high to the 40,000 foot level. This country is still in a very long term fight about whether or not to have bigger government or smaller government, tax and spend, the fight over the debt, the fight over the Budget Control Act and sequester and spending and the ceiling, the purpose of government. I mean, that's the fundamental fight in Washington right now. That's what Pelosi and McConnell are dealing with. Now, at the national security level, we're talking about should the budget be $560 billion or $600 billion or $650 billion? It really doesn't matter. It's chump change compared to the entire federal budget. And it also has zero political clout with those the partisan policy leaders in the House and Senate. I mean, for 3 years now, we've heard these national security leaders like McCain on the right and left begging their political bosses to not let sequester happen, don't pass these spending caps, it's bad for national security, and they've been completely ignored. Politics has ruled the day.
Let's go back to our callers now. We've got Julie with us in Price County. Julie, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that I would support an increase in the military spending if it was for health services and mental health care for our servicemen. I just don't think we need to build more ships and bombs and go that route. But the other thing I wanted to comment on was that Trump is asking NATO, our NATO partners, to pick up the slack around the world as far as where the United States has been supporting military operations and things like that. So if NATO is supposed to pick up the slack, what is the point in increasing our military?
Julie, thanks for the call. A lot to tackle there. Kevin, let's start with some of this money would be used for more ships and equipment, which Julie wasn't wild about. But any thought that some of this might go toward health care, mental health services for current and former service members?
Yes, but I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive. Don't think of it as a zero-sum game. If you a dollar has to go to a ship or has to go to a service for troops and families, it just doesn't work that way. The Pentagon has spent a lot of time and effort in the last few years to vastly improve its services, especially mental health, to fight suicide among the ranks, to help out with PTS and the effects of the wars that have been going on. And that's a multi-decade type of concern that they're going to have. I mean, I think there are far more World War II veterans that have PTS that are being seen for issue than there are Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. So, anyone who fought in those wars has issues now for the rest of their lives, if you think about it that way. What's changed is instead of 150,000 troops on multiple deployments in Iraq, we have 5,000 in Iraq. But they're special operators, and they go multiple deployments, and almost all of them are in the thick of the fight. These aren't logistics guys on the back lines. So you have a different group of people. Women is a good example. Women being open, or the ranks opening up to more women in combat, is going to mean that there are going to be very specific issues for women's mental health that haven't had to be dealt with at scale as they were before. So I think there is a lot of money. There's a lot of effort to take care of the troops. It could always be done better, but that's there. That's not going to take. I don't think those are things that take away from equipment from weapons.
And Julie also mentioned NATO, the idea from the Trump administration being we're going to get our NATO partners to pay more for defense. That'll allow us, Julie would think, to spend less.
Right. Well, but if they don't spend more, then you got to spend more yourself, right? And frankly, even if NATO does all spend more, meaning if every NATO country meets their pledge of 2% of their GDP, frankly, that's still not enough to pay for the type of security the world needs, according to the current national security strategy, and definitely according to what Trump has been saying and some of the Republicans on the Hill who want more, like John McCain. The Navy is a good example where there are some who have said, to do everything that the United States assumes the Navy could do, you would need 900 ships in a perfect world, not 300 that we currently have. Because in a perfect world, you would have one ship deployed, another ship in dry dock or in back in the docks getting maintained and fitted up, and then another one being ready to go for the next deployment to rotate in. Well, we don't live in a perfect world, so we have 300 ships. And by the way, the reason the Navy had more than 1,000 ships back in the day was because they're not the ships of today. Today's ships are armed with incredibly more sophisticated defenses and weapon systems, and they're linked to satellite networks. It's a whole different era. So counting ships, counting planes, isn't the way to measure the effectiveness or the lethality of the military. But that's a battle that the Hill and everyone likes to have. This is politics. You pick your metric and you put it out there as your reason for existing.
Talking to Kevin Barron from Defense One about President Trump's proposed defense spending increases. We go next to Tim on the line in Wausau. Tim, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I think that it is needed. We need, and McCain is probably right, but I think where a lot of the money should go is to enlisted people, the people that are going to be in the ranks and everything else. There's no incentive for those, for a high school individual to even get in the military. I mean, he can go work at McDonald's and make the same amount of money.
Tim, thanks for the call. Better pay for the enlisted troops in the different services. Kevin, is there a case there?
Well, I don't know if you can make the same amount of money for McDonald's. And frankly, you're not serving your country at McDonald's necessarily, and you don't get the benefits and everything else to go with it. But the caller does have an absolute concern about, the purpose of joining the military. And if you're going to expand the ranks, well, where are you going to get them from, right? And are they, and why are they joining in the first place? So there's an interesting background about how this changed the moment 9/11 happened. For many years, the military, the all-volunteer force after Vietnam was consisted of people that either served because they had some sense of duty and they basically probably were from a military family or lived near a military base, like in Fayetteville at Fort Bragg or somewhere like that. Or you did it because of the quick money. It was a way out of the ghetto. It was a way out of, rural America where there weren't as many jobs or a way out of your family that you became the first person to get to college.
And I'm sorry, Kevin, I'm going to have to cut you off there. We're out of time. We've been talking, but thank you for joining us. That was Kevin Barron from Defense One looking at a proposed increase in military spending from the White House.
I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.